Sí. Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen. Good afternoon and welcome. I'm Grant Hedding, President of the South Australian Press Club, and I'd like to issue a very special welcome to our guest today, Treasurer Kevin Foley, who's left a Cabinet meeting early to join us, so we certainly appreciate that. Kevin tells me that he spent this morning at the dentist getting some repair work done, and I said which was worse, the Cabinet or the dentist, and he'd said he'd take the dentist any time. The Press Club appreciates the support of all of its corporate and media partners, and today we have with us Telstra Countrywide Areas General Manager Colette Smith, Jeff Timms from Timms Manufacturing Jewellers, and Robbie Cooter, Timms from SA Brewing. And also with us today, Vicky Chapman, the Member for Bragg, and from the Upper House, David Ridgway and Tammy Jennings. We're enjoying wines from Jacobs Creek and beers from SA Brewing, and you'll also notice on your tables there raffle tickets, three for $5. Prizes today include a $300 voucher from Timms Manufacturing Jewellers, beer from SA Brewing, and a prize pack from Network 10 with a lot of MasterChef merchandise. Now, after Mr Foley's address, I will invite questions from the floor, but priority will be given to journalists. So enjoy your meal, and we'll hear from Mr Foley shortly. Thank you. Excuse me again, ladies and gentlemen. Please keep eating. What we thought, the sooner we get underway, the more time we have at the end for some questions. Our guest today has shown plenty of talent for grabbing headlines, both welcome and unwelcome. Whether it be his uncompromising public persona, his personal life and loves, or at times even a dash of his state of mind while minding the state. Kevin Foley is certainly not one to mince his words, his often sharp tongue at times running away, just ask Nick Xenophon. He's perhaps only shy when it comes to his future aspirations. And he's not always had the smoothest working relationship with members of the Fourth Estate. Sometimes the Treasurer seems to flag he's looking for a mellower image. Not quite sure how that's working out. Mr Foley admitted during the budget lock-up he's had a bit of a rocky road in recent months. The man who so often bludgeoned opponents verbally, be they across the chamber or across the world, found himself on the receiving end of sustained pressure. A surprisingly frank confession to his ranking in the toolbox of life, provoked by a slip of the memory on just what he knew when about the Adelaide Oval. For a showman like the Treasurer, budget time is the pinnacle, the aria, the grand final. Kevin, for a die-hard Port fan, it must be nice to be in one. The GFC sent a reminder that state finances could not simply be held at arm's length from the rest of the world, and allowance has to be made for sudden reverses. The Sustainable Budget Commission made more than 300 pages of recommendations for cuts, only for a leaked USB to steal the Treasurer's Budget Day thunder. Kevin Foley, now the dust has settled from last Thursday, we look forward to hearing from you. Ladies and gentlemen, Kevin Foley.
Well, good afternoon all, and thank you very much, Grant, and to Colette Smith, Area General Manager for Telstra Countrywide. Jeff Timms from Adelaide's most outstanding jeweller, Timms Manufacturing Jewellers, and Robbie Cooter Timms representing SA Brewery. Vicky Chapman, of course, the state member for Bragg, leader of the Upper House for the Liberal Party, the Honourable David Ridgway, MLC, and to the Honourable Tammy Jennings, MLC, representing the opposition invited guests. Can I just start by saying that, as Grant alluded to, or Frank, I think it was, I've been to the dentist this morning because I had my wisdom teeth out, and I'm not expecting sympathy here, but the lower right-hand wisdom, where it was, whilst you're eating, I'll be careful what I say, but the wound has opened up and it's been infected, so it was really painful on the weekend. So I've been to the dentist this morning. He's dosed me up on antibiotics and Panadine Fort. So I'm feeling pretty relaxed up here right now and cruising. So I know I'm amongst friends, so if anything I say is like a bit controversial or sort of from left field, or, you know, I say something really stupid, just do us a favour, guys, and don't report it. I can trust you on that, can't I? Yeah, like, as if. What I want to do very quickly, and I do apologise to those journalists in the room who have seen this tutorial before, not that you were probably paying that much attention, but I'm going to run through again just very quickly for others in the room just exactly the framework of the budget and what we're trying to achieve, and then I will open myself up for as many questions as possible up until 2 o'clock. And I can stay longer too if you want, but I guess by then you'll have a gutful of me. Okay, now this is going to be a bit difficult for me, but what we've done here is, and I've got slides so I don't actually have to look at it, but over 4 years the budget includes, the 2010-11 budget includes new expenditure of some $2.8 billion, which does cover all of our election commitments. It continues what is a record for this state in terms of capital investment, and the reality of the issue that I consistently talk about is the biggest single challenge to me as Treasurer, to our Cabinet, and will be to future Treasurers, as it has been in the past, and that is health. Health is still running at somewhere between 9 and 11% compound. That's activity growth. It's not wasted money. It's not things we choose to do because we feel like it, the number of people coming into our hospitals. What is concerning me, and I don't think scares me is too emotive a word, is that I have this inkling now, this feeling that as we age as a society, you know, we've done all the trends, all the mappings as to where health expenditure is going. What's worrying me is I think it's accelerating. I think we're getting older quicker, if that's possible. That is the real challenge. And obviously technology and new ways of keeping us alive a lot longer. It is just a horrendous challenge at a state level, and that's why I'm very pleased that the Commonwealth Government has at least put their feet on the sticky flypaper of Commonwealth of state health funding. Clearly, the budget, the main priority for this budget was a savings task. What I have done is implemented savings and some revenue measures that provides the budget with relief of some $2.5 billion and surpluses from year 10-11 forward. Just quickly, the budget position as it stands, we have a net operating deficit in 2010-11, following by surpluses across the forward estimates. Now, you'll see a deficit of 389 in 10-11 and a surplus of 167, in fact, 30 June this year. The way we account under accrual accounting and the government's accounting requirements is a number of factors make that deficit for this year much larger than it will turn out. That is what we call our carryover policy, brought to fame and attention by the Lennon v Government recent court case. That is where unspent monies can be carried into, provided they're authorised, into the next year. But what that does is, so let's say we have a $167 million surplus in the 9-10 year, 9-10, let's say 120 of that is what we call carryovers, money that should have been spent that year that wasn't and legitimately has to be carried over to the next year. It just means you start, your bottom line starts negative or in a worse position by the amount of carryovers. Also in that 389 number is a large component of the initial tranche of separation packages that we're providing to our public service to downsize our public service, together with some Commonwealth money from the stimulus money that is being expended in that year, so they're one-off. So whilst that is a large number, the reality is actually a much, much lower number, and I'd be very surprised at the end of this year, this fiscal year, that number isn't down a couple of hundred million dollars, if not more. As you can see, I've put a projected fifth year in the forward estimates, and that shows an $840 million surplus. Importantly, the trend is in the right way. Debt is peaking in 2012-13, and then will start to come down by 2014-15. Our ratios, the net financial liabilities, are a little higher than I would like, but given the overall structural shape of the budget and the fact that the debt that we're incurring is largely capital investment, the rating agencies are quite comfortable with the balance sheet as it stands. The adverse impacts of the global financial crisis did hit South Australia, despite the fact that it hasn't hit Australia anywhere near it has the rest of the world. We had been forecasting in the 8-9 budget somewhere in the order of a loss of state revenue and Commonwealth revenue to South Australia of in excess of $3.2 billion. Now, as it occurred, I think largely because of the work done by Labor and Liberal governments federally over 20 years, we've got our national economy, our structure of our economy, in bloody good shape. Like no other country in the world, Australia has all of the mechanisms at its disposal, that is the market mechanisms of an open economy, a floating exchange rate, competition policy, really good internal microeconomic policies that have meant that our economy has been able to adjust accordingly, notwithstanding China. We have had China, and you can't ignore that. But the other thing, of course, was the significant stimulus provided very early in the piece and not left till later in the crisis. But the reality is that our state is still down $1.4 billion from where we had predicted back in the 8-9 budget. And bearing in mind, in the 8-9 budget, I think it's the 30th of June 2008, we had a limited all-state budget debt. In fact, what we had were financial assets. That is, I think we had upwards of $300 million that had actually accrued as a financial asset. So we were budget debt free. We have debt in our utilities and we have an unfunded liability, which is the inheritance of former governments in terms of how that's been allowed to accrue. But we were in a very, very strong position. So when we hear this argument about rivers of gold, what have you done with it? Well, by 2008-09, we'd paid off all estate debt. We had accrued assets and we had cut taxes and we'd put, you know, that so-called rivers of gold into improving services. Not much else you can do with it. It would be nonsensical to just continually build up state assets if you have a budget debt of zero. I mean, you could pay off your unfunded liabilities and that is an argument. It's not one that I would support, but that would have been the only other thing you could have done with that money other than spending it or reducing taxes, of which we did both. Now, also what we did with the GFC is at the encouragement of the Commonwealth, and because we had the budget ability to do it, is we did embark upon a significant capital reinvestment program. State capital expenditure when we came to office was around about $500 million. It was actually just below the depreciation line in the accounts. So we were in a sense disinvesting or de-investing, whatever the term is, in our state's capital fabric, and we've moved on to ensure that we improve our capital position. And on that, that does mean things like the electrification of Adelaide's entire rail network, which fits in perfectly with our soon-to-be-released 30-year plan, where we are able, with an incredible amount of accuracy, predict how many people will live in Adelaide in 30 years' time. And when you put the outer boundaries, which we have in our city, we can identify how many vacant quarter-acre blocks, or whatever the size of a normal housing block is today, sort of the broad acre, the traditional front yard, backyard home, and there is a significant deficit in the land that we need to house the people. So what we've talked about for a couple of years now, and it will really flow through shortly in our public announcements, is that we will go for density, inner city density. We will use land that is derelict or hasn't been thought of for housing. We're going to look at multi-rise, albeit a limited size. We're not going for huge towers. But we're going to create a different urban environment as we start to cater for what is the natural population growth that will occur over the next 30 years. Now, in the next slide, obviously we released one prematurely, our reports from the Sustainable Budget Commission. Volume 1 of the Commission's report outlined 43 general recommendations. We have adopted a large proportion of those, but those recommendations go to functionality of government, structures of government, some other work we need to do in investigating some agencies, and, of course, the task that we had given the agency initially was to find us, or the Commission, to find $750 million over 3 years. We also then included into it savings that we had announced in previous budgets, and the year in which they were needed to be delivered hadn't arrived, and the agency hadn't necessarily identified them at that stage. We rolled them in, and then as the Commission recommended to me, is that they should also go for a further quantum of money to give us enough budget capacity to withstand any future economic shocks and to cater for the obvious pressures, particularly in health and families and communities. Now, I've copped a lot of criticism about the Sustainable Budget Commission. Obviously, I reject that. The reality is, with state government budgeting, regardless of who is the treasurer of the day, we will always, trust me, the rhetoric of my opponents and the rhetoric of some who think this was not a necessary process, the reality is every 6, 7, 8 years, governments of the day will have to go back, pore over every single agency expenditure line, and start to look at what it no longer can afford to do, what is no longer a priority. Because the pressures on us, particularly in the health and the ageing of our community, are so dramatic, so drastic and so ever-present that we will have no way of maintaining a budget balance and a AAA unless we keep going back, going back, going back and stripping out savings. Might also point out, just for my own, not that I'm into self-acknowledgement or greatness being acknowledged, but I did read the Financial Review today, who thought the Sustainable Budget Commission was such a good idea, and particularly given I used Jeff Carmody, who did the work for John Howard, that perhaps the federal government and other state governments should actually adopt that model. So from a very conservative financial paper, I took that as a credit, although it did also say that South Australia should stand on its own 2 feet and stop getting assistance from the other states, so that part of the article was crap. Now, we'll move on. The savings task has been well spoken about. I'll move on to the reform of the public sector. This gets move on that slide. We've got public sector. This excites a few people around. I'm sure it will a question or two. The reality is in government, I guess not much different to a lot of the businesses that are represented here today. Salaries represent 70 cents in the dollar, thereabouts. Not in all cases, but across government average, 70 cents in the dollar. You cannot bring down expenditure without reducing FTEs. I've been criticised in the past because we have employed some 15-plus thousand more FTEs since we came to office in 2002. The reality is they're not just people we hired to sit in an office and twiddle their thumbs. When you spend money, particularly in the health area, the families and community area, education, police, you're employing people. You can't spend an extra $200 million on health and not employ a substantial number of doctors, nurses, clerical as well as orderly staff. What we've said in this budget is a total of some 3,743 FTEs will be exited from the public sector over the next 4 years. That will be offset in part by the hiring of some 1,981 people for the new expenditures that we outlined in the budget that we've approved from our election. But what it does require is a very large and a very targeted voluntary separation package. What I want to resist doing in this package is what we've done in the past. You open up these packages to everyone in the public service, you can get your numbers in quantum, but what ends up happening is the very good people stick their hand up, get their 120 grand, walk out and get a job the next day in the private sector. You know, that really doesn't serve public policy well, and it doesn't serve the future of the public service. Now, what we're offering here is, I've got to say, it is very generous, but it's generous for one important point, because we want to encourage people to move quickly, to make a decision when they're tapped on the shoulder that their program has been ceased and exit the system. The payback period is very quick. some 18-month periods, some 18-month payback. What occurs is a program in an agency will be identified as a program that we're stopping, cancelling or modifying or changing. The excess employees that will no longer be required to deliver that program will effectively be put into a vehicle. Let's say it's the redeployee list, for want of a better word. That person from that day forth will be given these choices. They can take a gold-plated separation package, 20 weeks pay for 3 weeks and 3 weeks per year of service up to 116 weeks maximum. Now, if after 6 months they choose not to take that extremely generous package, they will slip down to a much leaner package, and that will be a package that offers 10 weeks pay up front plus 3 weeks per year of service up to 88 weeks. Now, that public servant may well take the chance or seek employment elsewhere in the public service. We have 3,000 to 4,000 positions each year become through natural attrition, so those vacancies open up, plus the other nearly 2,000 jobs that we're putting into the system with new spending. So there is plenty of opportunity if somebody wants to seek one of those positions, and that suits me fine because it still keeps the headcount down. Now, if for some reason the officer involved takes neither package, and hasn't been successful by the end of that 12-month period, the government has made it very clear, and there is no shade of light between the Premier and I on this. This is the stated government position. The government will revisit our no-forced redundancy policy because the savings task, the FTE reduction, the personnel reduction necessary is mandatory. There is no give. It is a line in the sand, and if we haven't been able to achieve it through what we consider to be extremely generous and fair packages, or the government will have no alternative but to consider, with obvious consequences, our no-force redundancy program. Going on to reforming the public sector, what the Commission was able to identify for us was a number of things that, quite frankly, I hadn't been presented with before. Now, one could be critical of the fact that no one has presented this to government before, but we started to look at the actual employment conditions of public servants. Now, 17.5% leave loading brought in by the late Clyde Cameron, and Clyde often said much later that it was one of his great mistakes in retrospect when he did that, was brought in to give shift workers, when they take holidays and they're not in receipt of their penalty payments, their overtime allowances, a continuation of roughly the same salary by which they were receiving. What it did is, over the years, and it happened in the private sector and the public sector, that 17.5% became standard in all wages across public and private sectors, mostly. Private sector, of course, over the last 10 or 15 years, as we've reformed the workplace and reform, they've been traded off or washed out through a large proportion of the private sector. What we're saying here is we intend to do the same for all public sector employee not on a shift. So if you're not a shift worker, we will be legislating for at the expiry of the current industrial agreement that 17.5% be removed. That gives the budget some $90 million of savings, $46 million of savings over the next 2 years, but it's part of a broader package. But the reality is we simply cannot afford to pay that money anymore. What we will be doing, though, is, and I think that's fair, we will be offsetting that decision by giving public servants affected by this an extra 2 days leave per year. The next one that really struck pretty hard was the long service leave provisions of public sector workers. What I asked to be done was to benchmark what is the national state government average, what is the Commonwealth. And we were up the top, or we are up the top, with a shining star. That is, we have, and then I benchmarked it against the private sector, and we were even further, we were more generous by a far greater amount. And just quickly, what that means is from 0 to 10 years, we're around about the public sector norm around Australia and the Australian average. From 10 years to 15, we're more generous than most states. But then when we hit the 15-year mark, it goes up like a rocket. what we do in our system of government is we give 3 weeks leave per year for every year of service post 15 years. And that is so out of line with what other state governments, the Commonwealth government, and certainly the private sector provide. That means that another 15 years, and there's a lot of 30-year public servants in the system, and will be, that of course means you can take nearly 1 year's leave at the end of that next 15 years. You could sort of retire a year earlier on a taxpayer-funded holiday. That is just out of whack, out of line, has to cease. And what we're doing is we're benchmarking our long service leave provisions back to what we consider on a benchmark standard to be the average for consistent with the private sector, and it puts us in the midpoint of what is offered between the various other state governments in South Australia. I don't want this to be too political. I know a few of my Liberal Party colleagues are here today. I really urge the Liberal Party to support what is sensible workplace condition reform, because it won't just help this government, it will help each and every government in decades to come, particularly the issue of a government prepared to revisit its no-force redundancy policy, because we can no longer have conditions that are archaic, that are just simply not consistent with what is common practice and best practice in the private sector. Those initiatives alone, and we're also cutting 20% of senior executives. We'll be taking about 120 senior executives out of our senior management, because we have become too bloated in that area. We need to be leaner, and they will be separated as per their contract decisions. That package gives us in excess of $200 million of savings over the next 4 years. We're also doing some things with our motor fleet vehicle and significant cuts in the area of economic development and trade. Coming on to health, we are requiring the health department. You cannot continually, you know, sort of allocate money to the health department and not expect the largest business in town to continually look at how it can be more efficient without affecting patient care. We are now spending $4.5 billion a year on health. When we came to office, it was a bit over $2.2 billion, 111% growth in 8 years, 8.5 years, and it shows no sign of abating. We're with the agreement with the Commonwealth. We have agreed that for the Commonwealth to participate in the funding of health, we would need we have to agree to what's called efficient pricing, where Commonwealth and the states are still working out exactly how they'll do that model, whether it will be through a statutory national body or whether it will be a committee of health bureaucrats. But they'll strike what is an efficient price for the for an activity in a hospital. So what's the efficient price of getting your cartilage fixed or a hip replacement, blah, blah, blah. We actually have to meet that. There's no if, no buts. In most of our hospitals, we are there. Some hospitals, some functions, they're not. So we're working on a program now to ensure that we can get down to best practice and efficient pricing. Also, in South Australia, we have, unlike the eastern states, and this, I think, certainly bears truth with my years of growing up, we, some would say I haven't yet reached that point, but South Australians, particularly Adelaideans, love going to hospitals. Like, you fall over and sprain your ankle, and I did a lot in footy, you'd go to the QEH and you'd sort of queue up and, you know, you hardly got a life-threatening serious injury, but we just go into hospitals. The other thing that we do way out of proportion to other states, particularly the eastern states, is people go to hospitals seeking referral to a specialist, and quite often there will be a long waiting list, and the patient just goes to the public outpatients, wants to see a specialist, waits a long time. That doesn't serve the patient any good, and it doesn't help the system, because that costs the state system a lot of money. What we're going to be doing is, through a system of encouragement, education, and various other measures, is doing what they do in each of the eastern seaboard states. Encourage people to go to your GP and get a referral to a specialist in their private practice. And you can normally get that often in a matter of weeks. Yes, not always will they bulk bill. There may be a gap fee payment, but that is a much better health outcome for the person if we're able to encourage them to do that as well. The other thing we're getting out of the business of is car parking. The Royal Adelaide has commercial car parking arrangements. There are very few, if any, hospitals along the eastern seaboard this day and age that are in the business of running free car parks. We can't afford it anymore. We will be putting commercial rates on our car parks and progressively selling off our car parks to commercial operators. Education, we're doing some savings there. Just quickly, adult re-entry, we're not taking adults into our school system anymore. They'll be encouraged to go to TAFE or to a private provider. For the mums in the room or the dads, the continuous intake of children, we're the only state in Australia where your kid turns five and you can drop him or her off at school the next day. We're going to have a once-a-year intake, which is consistent with every other year, and there will be arrangements as, you know, which 6 months of the year the child is born in terms of whether they go in for four terms or you know, 12 months or 18 months. What we can't have, what we want to make sure is we actually make sure a young kid gets a full year of schooling, and that provides us with some budget relief. I should just quickly skip through royalties from 3.5 up to 5, consistent with the Liberal Premier, Colin Barnett in the West. We should be getting more rent. I mean, a royalty is our rent for a mining company to make a profit out of something that is naturally ours within our state borders. First home buyers, we are cancelling the first home buyers scheme for existing homes, but doubling it for new builds. It's a budget savings measure, but we think it's much better targeted. You'll still be able to get the Commonwealth $7,000, not just our extra $4,000 top-up. A couple of controversial ones. We're eliminating a petroleum subsidy program that's been in place since the High Court challenged the state's rights to levy these taxes back in the 80s, early 90s, where it's about 0.25%, I think, from 50 to 100 kilometres out of the city, and then post 100, it's 3.2 cents. In this day and age of volatility in petrol pricing, we don't believe that's a position the state needs to be in any further. A landholder model, and I'm happy to give you a deeper understanding of what this means, but we're going from a land-rich provision to a landholder model, basically means major corporations that have big buildings have been able to structure their ownerships to avoid a large proportion of stamp duty, which they otherwise would be having to pay when these transactions occur. Again, bring us into line with other states. I'm getting rid of an old payroll tax exporters rebate scheme. It's about $10 million saving over 3 years. That goes back to the 1990s. You know, we've cut payroll tax to such an extent since coming to office. It's about $300 million per year. By the end of the forward estimates, we will have reduced payroll tax. Exporters don't need this anymore, and I'll go he if anyone actually exports an extra widget because we give them a 20% discount on a payroll tax. Cellar door sales, we've been giving millions of dollars a year, largely to large national and multinational wine companies to subsidise their cellar door sales. Again, that is an antiquated, and it's in the old days of government handouts. We're getting rid of that. We're keeping it a cap of 50,000, so the smaller wineries still receive some incentive to keep their doors open. But again, this is not the day, you know, the time has passed when government should be in this space. Quite controversial, we're increasing speeding fines. That gets the media excited. As I said, that's really a voluntary tax. If you don't want to pay it, you know the obvious behaviour you need to undertake. The victim of crime levy is increasing by $30, again, a voluntary tax. If you choose not to pay it, if you don't want to pay it, don't commit a crime. Increasing the solid waste levy because we're a green, environmentally conscious government, and there's a small increase in TAFE student fees. New spending, I don't want to go through all of that. We've been through it extensively, but there's a large package from our election campaign. Moving into infrastructure, just to repeat, we have got nearly $11 billion of infrastructure spend over the next 4 years, which includes a further $580 to complete the desal plant, $1.4 billion yet to be spent on the rail electrification projects, nearly $900 for major projects with the South Road and Port River expressways, nearly half a billion to finally have a two-lane highway down south. $420 million for ongoing public housing construction and redevelopment, $394 million for the expansion of the Adelaide Convention Centre, which will give us, we're losing competition to Victoria because they've gone massive. We don't have to go as large as Victoria, but we do need to have increased capacity. And the economic benefit of that for the state is quite extraordinary. Another $150 million for the QEH. And a pet project of mine, $535 million has been allocated for the redevelopment of the Adelaide Oval, which, trust me, will go ahead. Finally, we're taking a punt on where the economy will be as we do. We think we'll have a near-record winter crop from our rural industries, giving us extremely good yields. The state's economy, we're tracking what the National is saying. I think these figures are probably a little conservative because we have outperformed the rest of the nation in recent years, but Treasury still like to have a fairly conservative outlook of 2.25 this current fiscal year up to 3.5 the following year. That's it. Are there any questions? No questions? All right, thank you very much. I'll see you guys later.
Journalists, line up out the back. There's a microphone there in the middle of the floor. Go for it.
Treasurer Nick Nolan from Fresh 92.7, Adelaide's only youth community radio station.
Bear in mind, Nick, I did an interview on Budget Night with your
Yes, I know, and very good it was too. Look, you mentioned that health costs are going to go up exponentially over the next few years, and in the past eight we've seen them increase by 111%. On your reckoning, even if they stay at that rate of increase, we're looking at $8.6 billion by 2018. Can we afford healthcare in South Australia long term?
Well, Nick, I mean, that's a very good question. I mean, it's, you know, Peter Costello identified this at the national level when he did the intergenerational report into pharmaceuticals. I mean, you go anywhere in the world, we have one of the truly great social policy instruments where if you're crook, you can actually get a decent drug at a very competitive subsidised price. And of course, the list grows as the drugs are developed. So that's one of the great nightmares confronting us. But the reality is, and it's in every Western world country, America is facing this nightmare with all of their other problems, but it's coming at us, Nick, and it's coming at us like a bullet train. And my fear is that it's accelerating. That's why I'm pleased that at least we've got the Commonwealth to put their feet on the sticky flypaper. It may not be everything we wanted, and it may not be as generous as we would like, but at least they are now in the mix. And as the pressures increase and increase and increase, the only real solution will be, and this will be well past my tenure as Treasurer, you know, I've got 7 years to go, but another 10, 15, 20 years, the Commonwealth will have to make a decision as to how it allocates its huge quantum of money. Does it spend as much on defence? Does it spend as much on social security? Does it spend as much on all the things the Commonwealth does, and does it therefore allocate more to the state system? That's the only real option, but that's also why we have to continually drive efficiencies to the best we can. And, you know, trust me, any treasurer in my job, be it next year or in 10 years' time, whenever that time comes, and it won't be next year, incidentally, but this is not something that I've manufactured. This is the reality.
Another Nick Treasurer, Nick Harmson from ABC News.
Hello,
Treasurer, over the past couple of days I've asked you some of the big picture questions of the budget, but I just want to burrow down into some of the finer details. One of the recommendations in the Sustainable Budget Commission's report was for ministerial chauffeurs to keep logbooks. It was a measure that would save about $1 million a year. And to any journalist who's been out on the road and seen ministerial drivers sit around, we know there's time in their day to complete that task, and it seems like a straightforward measure. Why haven't you adopted that measure? Is it because you're concerned that journalists will be FOIing ministerial logbooks? And if that's not the case, what justification do you give not adopting such a simple measure when there are jobs being cut and taxes being increased?
You know, what I like, Nick, you're a terrific reporter, but you know what this shows is this obsession in Adelaide and South Australia with the micro stuff. You know, okay, maybe I do earn more than I should. Maybe I have a chauffeur-driven car that I have available to me. You know, that's what we have. The Leader of the Opposition and David Ridgway here has the same. The amount of public scrutiny we are put under as in terms of how we use and indeed abuse this privilege is pretty intense. And, you know, if you want to take chauffeur cars away from politicians, if you want to have us walk to work, that's fine, I'll do it. But don't expect a lot of people in the future necessarily to be lining up for what I believe to be one of the most important jobs there is in South Australia, my profession as a politician. And you can keep kicking the crap out of us, you can keep drilling down as to what we do wrong and why we shouldn't do this and why do you get this perk or whatever. But I can tell you, when a David Ridgway or a Vicky Chapman goes to work or a Kevin Foley goes to work, we put our heart and soul into this job. You know, we don't always get it right. We'll always have differences. But I've got to say, if Vicky Chapman was a barrister at the bar now, she'd be earning a hell of a lot more than what she is now. And so would many of my colleagues. And what we've got to at least appreciate is that we need to have a decent quality of person who is legislating and making the laws of our state. You know, if you want to have a pack of dunderheads, so be it. So I make no apology for at least ensuring that we have a level of remuneration and benefit commensurate with the position. Thanks, Nick.
Can I just ask a follow-up on that, Treasurer? This measure would not require you or any other minister to do anything any different. You wouldn't lose your car. It would simply be drivers keeping a logbook. Why the decision not to adopt that measure?
I've got to tell you, Nick, of all the decisions I've had to pore over in the last 2 or 3 months, a logbook for a government driver has not been high on the list. I'll have to get back to you with a more considered answer. You know, I'm about cutting billions of dollars.
Treasurer, Sarah Martin from The Advertiser. Treasurer, can you explain why funds for the convention centre upgrade, the $394 million, have been listed as an equity injection, not a capital ongoing capital works payment, which means it doesn't show up in the measure of surplus and deficit?
Good question. The convention centre is a government business enterprise. It's not part of what we call the general government sector. So it's not like it's the tourism department. If it was the tourism department who had management control of the convention centre, it would be a capital payment transfer appropriation of the tourism department. The convention centre is a government business enterprise and it is run by a board and is corporatised and it's an off-budget or off-balance sheet entity for the context of its operations. At times it pays a small dividend to government. Other examples of this are SA Water. Other examples of it are, what was TransAdelaide, Homestart, for example. So when we transfer money of such quantity to this entity, it is deemed an equity injection from government. It still appears on our balance sheet. It doesn't appear as general government sector debt. It appears as a liability. And when the rating agencies look at our books, they take that into account as overall government debt.
Treasurer, Alan Murrell from Channel 10.
I love this idea. Can we do this every week when we have a press conference?
It might be a good idea.
I went to Japan and did a press conference, they all bowed before and after. So a little bow would be nice too, Mr. Murrell.
Perhaps. The Under-Treasurer was giving evidence this morning about various recommendations which had been rejected. One of them was that the state stopped paying $300,000 or $400,000 to S&P. As part of the ratings process, and this was rejected. Is there not an issue that there's an appearance of a conflict in paying for an agency which provides a rating, given some of the criticism of agencies during the GFC?
An absolute conflict. That's why we pay it.
Sorry?
I said it's an absolute conflict. That's why we pay it. Well, I mean, it's an obvious conflict if you pay an agency that rates you, but it's been the practice of governments for decades. You know, when I first came to office, I was told, you know, let's save $500,000 a year and not rate Moody's. Well, the minute you do that is that, and look, that amount of money doesn't affect how they rate us, but what it allows us to do is to have dialogue, to discuss with them, to present, as I've done now for 9 budgets, the last two, in fact, I've done prior to the budget. It allows us to have ongoing dialogue. It allows them to come and visit us. If we didn't pay the rating agencies, they would rate us on published data without having a deep understanding of what lies behind the numbers. And for the sake of a $400,000 a year payment to rating agencies, it is worth the investment. It's what former Liberal governments did, and it's what I intend to do, and a future Treasurer would be a mug to stop doing it.
Thank you.
Greg Kelton from the Advertiser, Treasurer.
Yes, Mr. Kelton.
Mr. Oh, thanks very much.
Just about. That's it. Do we get a camera on that? I want to see that on television.
You just said that...
Your man's a little bloody wacky around the head for that.
You've got another 7 years in Parliament.
Yep.
Why this sudden lease of life? Does this mean that you will get... Will you guarantee that you're going to stay in Parliament until 2018? And also, do you have some sort of Kirribilli agreement with the Premier?
Oh, I tell you what, if we had a Kirribilli house here, I probably would have had a crack at the Premiership a few years ago. Not a bad set of digs. No, there's no Kirribilli, and I'm quite enjoying what I'm doing, and I'll just keep doing it for as long as I can.
Hello, Angelique Johnson, ABC News.
Yes. You don't have to bow, that would be...
When WT Partnerships costed the opposition's rebuild of the Royal Adelaide Hospital, you described those costings as shoddy.
Of a Murray houseboat, yep.
Budget and Finance Committee this morning heard that WT Partnerships were paid $46,000 by the government in 08-09 financial year to provide an assessment of cost estimates for public-private partnerships.
Yep.
So my question is, do you also consider those costings done by WT Partnerships for the government to be shoddy?
Not at all, because they were given proper writing instructions, proper brief. To this day, despite the government coming under enormous pressure from the media and my opponents, to this day we've never seen detailed drawings or detailed site plans or costings or anything in terms of what is the so-called Liberal Party's alternative football stadium proposal for South Australia. It was what it was. It was a very shoddy piece of work and a number plucked out of the air. To build a new stadium in this state would cost in excess of $1 billion, probably at least $1.2 billion. Where would you build it? We're going to build a hospital there. If you reckon you've got troubles getting a grandstand built at Victoria Park, imagine trying to build a grandstand on another part of the, or an oval on another part of the parklands. But again, Telstra Dome is a very expensive asset to operate. They spend $2 million a year repairing the turf. They have 44 games a year, and I think they make a small operating profit. Here in Adelaide, we'd have 22 games a year, and it is as simple as this. As idealistic as it may be, as a dream that we may all would have loved to have had, we simply can't afford it. And one of the great problems in this state is we have overcapitalised sporting infrastructure. We've done it with an entertainment centre, a basketball centre, a netball centre. You know, hello, we could have had one centre. And that was mistakes of the former Labor government. We just don't have the population and we don't have the wealth in this state to have an Adelaide Oval and a football park. Adelaide Oval will go down when it's completed as one of the great decisions of this government, because what it will do is open up a precinct that has been derelict and left to look like a country town as you look out the window as you drive through that stretch of the Torrens. You'll have the convention centre, you'll have restaurants, you'll have the footbridge, you'll have activity, you'll have a plaza on the Adelaide Oval side, you'll have activity, you'll have people coming into the city. I'm very proud of that development. Patrick now has got hold of it, he'll deliver it, and it'll be a great lasting legacy of this government. Michael Owen. Now please, you must bow.
Treasurer, Michael Owen from the Australian.
Not unless you bow. I'm not answering unless you
bow. I couldn't do that. Not here. Greg Kelton.
No. Do not read anything into that.
I'm not ruling anything out.
Do not read anything into that. I want him up for slander.
Look, Greg Kelton touched on this before, so I just want to explore a little bit further. You've clearly got a vision for Adelaide and for South Australia. You've been around a long time. You have great ambition. If the state and the party required it, do you think that you could be Premier?
If the state or the party required it? Well, I don't
see... Could you step up to the plate and be Premier?
Look, mate, you know, I'm just happy doing what I do. And
That's nice, but could you be Premier?
I try and do the best that I can. And, you know, I've said repeatedly, I've never had an ambition to be Premier, and I'm quite happy doing the job I do. I don't have enough trouble holding on to this one. You reckon I'm going to have a crack at the next one? Jeepers, give me a break. No, I'm happy where I am, mate. Happy as the proverbial.
One more question on a different matter. Do you share the Premier's view that many of the recommendations in the leaked report from the Commission were simply dopey? They were just stupid recommendations.
Well, I perhaps wouldn't have used those words, but clearly some of the recommendations were from left field, and to be honest, the people who did the work acknowledged that to me. I mean, what we asked the Commission to do was a no-holes-barred, no political constraints, no writing instructions, and don't have a think about or don't have a concern about the politics. That's what we're employed to do. It's no wonder. No wonder they came up with such a vast array of surprises. That didn't surprise me at all.
News Treasurer. A couple of budgets ago, you pointed out that about a 1% bump in public sector salaries was worth about $250 million.
Yep.
And you wanted a cap on public sector salaries. Does that, is that still an assumption over the forward estimates, the 2.5% cap?
Well, what I'm always reluctant, Chris, to say what I have in... Not reluctant, I just don't say what I have in the budget for wages provisioning, because that would be that would tip my hand at the public sector unions. But
you did previously say 2.5%.
Oh, yeah. No. I'm not walking away from the outcome I want. Now, with the general public sector EBA that we just recently went into about 6-8 months ago, from memory, that was a headline figure of 2.5% plus an upfront payment. So it came in about 3.1. Now, I would have preferred 2.5, but I have to say 3.1 was probably the best a government at a state level has been able to achieve from its workforce for many decades, and I reckon there'd be not too many private sector employers out there who have been able to get their wages away at 3.1. We've still got a number of EBs to roll out over the next few months. A 2.5% outcome is our absolute point we're driving for, but the reality is, particularly as we saw with the teachers, if they go to the Commission, a lot of this gets out of our hands. Okay, Alan.
Mr. Treasurer, do I need to bow? Do you want me to bow or not?
No, Alan, I should be bowing to you.
Mr. Treasurer, I'm Alan Arden from Murray Bridge. Regional Development Australia is very important to our region, as our other regional areas, and I'm a bit concerned that the news that we heard that your government won't fund this after 2013, is it?
Which was that? Sorry, Alan?
The Regional Development Australia funding after 2013, after we contracted up till 2013. My understanding was that your government wasn't going to fund it.
Well, I'm not sure if you're talking about the Regional Development Infrastructure Fund, state-based program.
No. What was the Regional Development Boards are now...
My apologies. Yeah. Yes, that is a function of this budget, Alan. I know it's tough, but we are looking at a major shake-up in how we fund our Regional Development Boards. This is the reality, and I use that word a lot, but as time goes on, whoever is in office, and I'm sure you do this at your own council level, there just reaches a point where there are things you simply can't afford to do anymore, or you can't afford to do to the same extent. That, you know, you've really got to, what is your top priority and what is a lower priority? And, you know, things are going to keep falling off that list as years go on to address the issue that Nick Nolan raised at the very beginning. But as long as this health roller coaster comes at us, I've got to find savings.
Thank you.
Tori Shepherd from the Advertiser.
Hi, Tori.
What role did your department heads play in what went on the SBC recommendations? So specifically, did Tony Sherbin approve or have any idea about the health cuts that were listed?
Oh, of course. I mean, what the process was...
Of course he approved them.
Sorry?
Of course he approved them.
Sorry, say that last bit again.
He approved them.
Well, yes. What occurred was each agency was asked to provide a menu of options to the Sustainable Budget Commission to meet certain targets. And to the best that I understand is that the SPC process individually met with CEs, with various line managers, and worked through a number of the options put up. And then they also then explored in dialogue other options that may not have been put up until they got a consolidated list. But that was done in the knowledge that there would be a whole raft of stuff that no sensible government, certainly a government as committed to improving health in this state, would agree to. But that I didn't want that stopped. So everything that was put up was put forward with the knowledge of CEs, not necessarily, I've got to point out, not with a stamp of approval as they want to do it. They were mandated to do a job, and their people had to bring those options forward.
So Dr Sherbin saw it as a possible option that closing the repat was not off the list altogether?
I don't know whether Tony Sherbin himself would have actually necessarily put that up. You know, I don't know how the inner workings worked. It may well be that the SPC said, we want to have a look at our hospitals and which hospitals do we think the state could get by without. I'd be surprised if that was put up necessarily as an option by Tony Sherbin. It was probably something that was requested from the SPC. It was an interactive process. So you can't, Tory, say that anything that was put up was put up with gusto by Tony Sherbin and with his stamp of approval. He may well have been instructed by the Sustainable Budget Commission to give them a list of hospitals, what their operating budgets are, and they may well have made that decision themselves.
Minister Foley, Richard Sage, I'm the Mayor of the Grant District Council. The question to you is, where do we sit now with the forward selling of SA Forest Pond?
Well, look, we're at a very close to making a decision. We announced back in the mid-year budget review, from memory, 18 months ago now, that we are selling forward rotations of our timber, not privatising SA Forest, but forward selling the timber. Normally these things are sold to superannuation funds. It's a very good income stream for them. It balances their portfolio. It allows us to capitalise the value of those timber assets and use that money to pay off state debt. We will make a decision very shortly on that. We're not privatising SA Forest, but we will continue with the program of forward selling of the forestries.
If you forward sell, what guarantee have our own local pine companies got that they'll have access to that timber when I know full well they're selling whole pine overseas now?
Well, because the marketing agent or the selling agent is SA Forest, Forestry SA. The owner of the trees transfers from the taxpayer to, you know, mutual community, a mutual MLC's superannuation fund or a conglomerate of superannuation funds. They get the income stream, but the sale, the selling agent, the marketer, the people that interact with people in the southeast, nothing changes.
Nothing changes. There's still no guarantee that we're going to have enough timber to run our own pine companies.
Well, it doesn't make it any less likely than if it was fully owned, you know, if the timber was still owned by government. You know, the marketing and the selling and the decisions taken by the Board of Forestry SA will be no different if the logs are owned by us or the logs are owned by a superannuation fund.
And the current value of that asset to the state returns
Sorry?
About the current asset of that to the state currently returns roughly 10% of the whole value.
Yeah, well, I mean, Forestry SA will still provide a dividend to the government. That'll be the profit it makes after its operating expenses and its own need to retain cash from the processing of those logs. The dividend will be smaller because we won't capture the full value of the log because we will have forward sold that value. But in terms of the operating outcome for the people in the southeast, nothing should change. Nothing will change. It's for all intensive purposes, it's a balance sheet transaction. It's a financial instrument that we're selling. Nothing will change from the people that deal with Forestry SA in the southeast.
Yeah, we'll okay. Watch that space. Just one more
yep.
question, with regard to shared services.
Yep.
Where do you see that now? Has it been the saviour that you thought it was going to be?
Well, I never said it would be a saviour, but again, it is a necessary piece of public sector reform. You know, I've got to keep, you know, surely you do in your council. I've got to keep sort of extracting every possible dollar I can out of non-frontline services. And shared services in this state will end up, in my view, be the model for all Australian governments. It is very much modelled on success in the private sector, where we will be putting all of our, some 28 or 32 independent human resources functions, purchasing functions, IR functions, stationary functions, ICT functions. into a consolidated unit, and we will reduce the number of FTEs and people considerably, and we will have common platforms across government. You know, only today was pointed out to me the plethora of platforms we have across government for simple financial procedures and financial accounting. It is appalling. Shared service is not without its difficulties, not without the odd hiccup, but it's a sensible reform. All major corporates are doing, and there's no reason why government shouldn't. Okay. Any other questions? I might just finish on one point, if I just can, very quickly, Grant. A couple of things have been said by my political opponents that I really need to knock on the head, particularly given I've got the calibre of senior journalists here today. Firstly is that somehow this state is massively in debt, akin to the state bank days. We're right back where we started. Let's remember the state bank collapsed nearly 20 years ago. When the State Bank of South Australia collapsed, the level of general government debt, budget debt, as distinct from the whole of government debt with these other entities, was 22.6% of gross state product. 22.6% of gross state product. The level of debt at June 30th, 2014, that I'm projecting, and it is going into capital, not into recurrent, is 3.8%. It's 3.8%. Because the value, the quantity of debt might be similar, but the economy has massively increased. So at the time of the State Bank, 22.6, now 3.8. The other thing that I do find amusing is I saw Stephen Baker, my old foe, on television the other night, very critical of what I had done. Well, Stephen hung around for 4 years before he made a decision to leave, but had Stephen Baker and Dean Brown done to South Australia's finances and balance sheet what Jeff Kennett did in Victoria, you could compare us to Victoria, because a lot of the hard work would have been done. I was in that parliament in 93. I know where that Liberal government shirked anywhere near the types of decisions that we have taken in this budget and previous budgets. It was a massively missed opportunity. So anyway, I thought I'd throw that in there. And finally, the last four Liberal budgets under Treasurer Rob Lucas had budget deficits. This is after they sold ETSA. After they sold ETSA, budget deficits from $215 million, $330 million, $297 million, $174 million. All right? So I'm happy to compare my track record to the Liberal Party any day, because we have outshone them on every single measure. Thank you very much. I hope I haven't bored you, and look forward to this time next year, Kimberley, if I can. Thank you.
Thank you, Kim. To paraphrase Mark Twain, rumours of Kevin Foley's political death appear to be grossly exaggerated. At his budget briefing last week, he boldly remarked, "I am back, bigger, better, stronger and more excited about my future than I've ever been." There's obviously a very clear message there to some in his own party, as well as those in the opposition. Thank you again, Kevin Foley. Ladies and gentlemen, please put your hands together for Kevin Foley. And there is a magnum of red, just to take away the pain a little bit more. I don't know whether you have to declare that or not.
No.
Kim, would you mind coming up for the raffle, please? Advertiser, Chief of Staff, as well as resident barrel girl. Now, no, you pick. You picking. Stir them up. And this is for the $300 voucher from Jeff Timms Manufacturing Jewellers. This is rigged.
Paul Starrick from the Tizer.
What are you going to do with jewellery? There's some beer here for... Oh, this is a red D61. No, D61s? Yes, one over there. Very good. And there's a gift pack there from Network 10. This is an Orange C35. There we go. Thank you very much. Yes. That's there, Wendy, for you. Just a reminder, our next lunch is on Wednesday, October the 27th, with sex therapist and author Bettina Arndt. Her latest book, What Men Want in Bed. I dare say it's probably not about having a good night's sleep. Our press club awards night too is on November the 19th. So that's one for our corporate and media sponsors as well, and for all the journalists in town. Thank you again, ladies and gentlemen, for coming today, and we wish you well for the rest of the afternoon.